Yeah, the timing could not be more fortuitous for giving a talk on inflation and cosmic microwave background, because the world just changed yesterday completely. And so my original title for my talk was a sort of a dry and boring one, you know, inflation after Planck. So now we have inflation after Planck and BICEP. But I still think that that's just like not exciting enough a title to fit the kind of excitement that we're feeling right now. So my third title slide is, and so, and what I want to talk about, especially in light of the BICEP results, is to really sort of explain the case for really believing that inflation is the right theory of the early universe in light of what we've seen from the data. And the case is becoming increasingly strong, I think, to really point your finger and say that inflation is the right way to go. And I want to motivate that in some detail using the cosmic microwave background data. And then I also want to talk about doing, you know, the question of doing model building around what around these new results. How are we going to, what kind of models do we need to construct that are going to be consistent with what we know from Planck and from BICEP, and hopefully from upcoming, you know, upcoming measurements will illuminate this. So the first thing I want to do is talk about inflation in the most general sense, why one might believe that it really is the right theory of the early universe. And then in the second part of the talk, I want to go and talk in more detail about model building as time permits. I have a lot of slides, so allow me to apologize at the beginning. This might run a little long.
So you're not Neil isn't here then.
Yeah. Okay.
That clock is 10 minutes.
Yeah, I know. It's actually 5 after 11. So let's dive right into it. So this is, I'd like to show this slide to start with, just to show how far we've come. This is actually the state-of-the-art in cosmic microwave background observations circa 1998. This was sort of a summary plot that Max Tegmark made of everything that was known at that time. So in 98, you can argue, is sort of the dawn of the lambda CDM, the concordance cosmology, right? It was the same year that the dark energy was discovered. The first acoustic peak you can see here was just starting to emerge from the data. You had measurements from Saskatoon showing the peak there, and then Ring and Cat showing the drop on the other side of that first acoustic peak. So in addition to the discovery of the dark energy in 1998, that year was also the first convincing evidence that you actually had an acoustic peak in the cosmic microwave background that was consistent with a flat universe as predicted by inflation. So now in 2014, we have a measurement like this of that same cosmic microwave background power spectrum. This is the Planck data plotted on a logarithmic scale, right? And so these error bars here, as I'm sure most everybody is well aware, all of the error bars all the way out to here are not dominated by instrument noise. They're dominated by cosmic variance. That is, that the size of these error bars is an artifact of the fact that we only have one universe to look at. So we only have one realization of a Gaussian random process. And these error bars get big at low multipoles at large angular scales because of the fact that you're averaging over large patch areas of the sky and you only have so many patches to average over. And so you have a 1 over square root of n error that dominates. Turns out that the Planck data are dominated by cosmic variance all the way out to an L of around 2,000 or so. This is really remarkable, and it's a milestone because that means we've measured the temperature anisotropy of the cosmic microwave background for all intents and purposes perfectly. We never have to go measure it again. An increase in sensitivity, a better instrument, will never get any better than that because we're already dominated by cosmic variance on this thing. So the temperature anisotropy of the cosmic microwave background is done, at least from the point of view of the primordial spectrum. If you go out to smaller angular scales than this, because of silk damping, you end up being dominated by foregrounds, by galaxy clusters and stuff, which is interesting physics, and people are going to be studying that for a long time. But if what your interest is in the early universe and the primordial power spectrum, then the temperature anisotropy is essentially complete, and we can move on to other things. Okay, and those other things, and from this, you can get a handful of parameters. We now have a pretty decent concordance cosmology, lambda cold dark matter, so we have a cosmological constant, matter. We know kind of when reionization happened. Spectral index we'll talk about. There's a little tension in the Hubble parameter between HST and Planck that's kind of interesting maybe. Age curvature is the universe is flat to a high degree of accuracy, now it's known. This is also a basic prediction of inflation. We have a 25 sigma detection of gravitational lensing by perturbations in the universe. Everything hangs together really pretty well for this kind of concordance cosmology, okay? Bicep. I love this picture. I mean, you can just see the B-modeness of it, you know, as it winds around. So this is the new result that just came out yesterday, and I think it's fair to say that everybody was pretty surprised at how big the B-mode signal was. You know, I know that I'd gotten conditioned into thinking, well, maybe it'll be a 10 to the minus 2 if we're lucky, and it's 0.2 instead. It's an order of magnitude bigger than I think most people suspected it was going to be. In fact, it's so big that it's actually creating a little bit of tension with Planck, and we'll talk about that as well, okay? So this is the sky map from BICEP. Here is the power spectrum, the B-mode power spectrum, and this is, they claim it's a 7 sigma detection. And that seems pretty believable, just eyeballing these points here. I mean, you can actually sort of see the little dip between when you're transitioning from the primordial B mode to the lensing signal. You can actually kind of see that thing dip down like that. So that's a remarkable result. Yeah, John.
Those 3 points to the right above 1 second.
Yeah, those are going to launch 1,000 papers, aren't they?
Another figure in the paper, figure 9, figure 7, there's an excess of data where there shouldn't be.
Yeah.
This bothers me.
I got nothing to tell you. I mean, yeah, that's kind of interesting, the fact that this is, you're actually seeing too much. Maybe this is an artifact of incomplete foreground removal. You know, this is hard, right? So a lot of the signal to noise over foregrounds is less than unity on all of these things, if I'm not mistaken. And so that this is highly dependent on how good you are at removing foregrounds, and you're probably... Oh, you want to scale everything down to fit those points in, and then, well, okay. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. If it's this big, you're probably going to see the reionization bump with Planck, right? No, the acoustic peak in the temperature is over here. Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, that is. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have the Keck points. Are they lower in this? Yeah. Okay. They know what's in the can with Keck, yeah. Time will tell. I mean, you really want to see this corroborated by an independent experiment before you really start throwing confetti, right? So. Not to my knowledge. Does anybody have any? I don't think they mention it in the paper specifically. It's big, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. When you have to get to this, you have to compare the data with the other experiments. What about the South Polar Telescope data? Why don't they say anything about that? It sits right next to the bicep.
Well.
And the bear.
Well, I mean, SPT is a whole other story, and I'm not going to get into that story, actually. I'll show you some results from Planck combined with SPT and other ones, right? So here's the result, basically, and this is the figure of merit that I'm going to use from the BICEP team, and there's a little ambiguity about this that we can discuss, but they say that it's consistent with a lambda CDM background, okay, with a tensor scalar ratio of 0.2 plus 0.07 minus 0.05 to 1 sigma. That's just amazing, right? And what this tells us, what do we learn from this? That immediately we learn the energy scale of inflation to a very high degree of accuracy, right? The energy scale of inflation goes as the fourth root of that. So those error bars are incredibly tiny when you map it onto lambda, right? So if this is essentially the height of the inflationary potential, it's r to the 1 quarter times 3.3 times 10 to the 16 GeV. So we have immediately nailed down the energy scale of inflation is between 2.1 and 2.4 times 10 to the 16 GeV to 1 sigma. Amazing. So now we know that if we're going to say inflation is the right model, and I want to try to convince you that.
Is that model dependent, so shooting star rock?
No, it's not model dependent. It's just, that's the value of the Hubble parameter. That's it. Right? Yeah, well, it's assuming Einstein gravity, yeah. Which last I checked works pretty well. Okay? So this is a very robust result. Okay? And it's the fact that you can, you know, now you're down to just like, you know, it's at the gut scale. End of story. Let's move on. So let's talk about inflation in general. I mean, the most general and basic predictions of inflation, I would argue, are the following three: adiabatic density perturbations, superhorizon correlations, and Gaussian statistics. I didn't put tensor modes up there because tensor modes are model dependent, right? If you have a low energy scale for inflation, the tensor modes would be too low for you to see. These are sort of the model independent predictions of inflation. And I want to go through these and in particular look at superhorizon correlations in a lot of detail, because that's really what tells you the story of inflation in particular. Let's look at adiabaticity first. You get adiabaticity very beautifully out of the E-mode polarization, and I love this figure from a 2009 paper by Komatsu. And the point is that polarization, the E-mode polarization, is strongest on gradients in the temperature. Okay? So what you see here is that here is a model of a cold spot, a simulation, and you see that the polarization is E-mode polarization runs along the gradients in the temperature. Here's an actual cold spot from the WMAP data, which is a beautiful match. And here's a hotspot simulation. So instead of winding around, it actually the polarization modes are radial. And here's an actual hotspot from the WMAP data. So these, when you really look at the temperature anisotropy in detail, the pattern of it is quite consistent with this idea that you have these coherent adiabatic perturbations in the baryons and the photons, where you're correlating the temperature as you would expect. So because the polarization is strongest along gradients in the temperature, what you find is that if you plot the TT spectrum and the EE spectrum, you expect them to be anti-correlated with one another. Where the TT spectrum peaks, you expect to have a flat spot in the EE spectrum and vice versa. And this is data from Quad that shows this. This is a bit of a cheat, of course, because this line is fit to an adiabatic power spectrum, right? So it looks better than it is, but if you kind of ignore the line and just look at the data points, you really see that it is quite consistent with that kind of anticorrelation that you expect from adiabatic perturbations. Okay? So as far as we can tell, there's the perturbations in the cosmic microwave background are purely adiabatic, as you would expect from single field slow roll inflation, or basically even more general models of inflation as well. Superhorizon correlations. So here's a diagram of the co-moving Hubble length during and after inflation. So this is where I've factored the expansion out. And so wavelengths are constant are of a constant scale in co-moving coordinates. And during inflation, during an accelerated expansion, the horizon shrinks. Then inflation ends, you have a period of reheating, you go into a period of decelerated expansion, presumably radiation domination. The expansion of the universe is decelerating, and the horizon, the cosmological horizon, increases in size again, right? So here's the picture, basically, of perturbation generation in inflation. Is I start out with some mode that's much smaller than my horizon during inflation. It's a quantum mode that I can that I know how to canonically quantize. That thing gets stretched out until it exits the horizon, and then its wavelength is actually longer than the horizon size of the universe. Later on, during the later decelerated expansion, that mode re-enters the universe as a classical perturbation and sources density perturbations and whatnot. So the way you generate perturbations in inflation is by having this horizon dynamics, where the horizon of the universe is shrinking in co-moving units so that you can create these superhorizon modes. Okay? And so you learn several things. One is that short wavelength modes exit toward the end of inflation, and long wavelength modes exit earlier in inflation. And if we take this green circle to be our current horizon size, the first modes to exit the horizon were the ones that are contributing, say, to the quadrupole today. Those are earlier in inflation than the high angular scale modes. And we know that the universe expanded by a factor of at least e to the 60 during this period in order to be consistent with flatness and homogeneity and whatnot. Initial conditions for inflation are observationally inaccessible, right? Things that exited the horizon earlier in inflation are still bigger than our horizon size today, and we can't see them. So we only see the last 60 e-folds of inflation, the very tail end of what was happening in the inflationary epoch. Inflation typically could go on 10,000 e-folds, or in fact, in eternal inflation, an arbitrarily large number. So there can be an incredible amount of inflation that's happening before this last little 60 e-folds that we have observational access to. We only see the very tail end of inflation in the cosmic microwave background. Right, and what you can see in the CMB is only about 4, actually. Right. Okay. So yeah, we only see the CMB only probes about 4 e-folds right around here, right? So that, I mean, but if you could go to really small scales, which would be cool, then you could learn all sorts of stuff about the very end of inflation where slow roll is breaking down. There'd be a lot of cool stuff if you could do small scale primordial perturbations, right? So, and in fact, what we see here is that we look at the cosmic microwave background, which was formed at a redshift of 1100, and we see that perturbations that are inside our horizon today were actually still well outside the horizon at the time of the formation of the cosmic microwave background. So the signal for these superhorizon, these acausal perturbations, is correlations in the cosmic microwave background polarization on multipoles less than 200 or so on superhorizon scales. And you see this very clearly, for example, in the TE cross-correlation in the WMAX spectra. Here's the angular scale of the horizon at the time of last scattering, and you see this characteristic anti-correlation between the temperature and the polarization that is essentially a smoking gun for superhorizon correlations in the perturbations at the time of last scattering. Okay, there's really no foreground for this that I'm aware of that anybody has proposed. So this tells you pretty cleanly that you actually had perturbations correlated on scales that were larger than the cosmological horizon at the time the cosmic microwave background was formed. And this, I want to argue, is the most compelling evidence for inflation being the model that happened. And I want to, this is some work that was really mostly Gosel's idea. And we wrote a paper a couple of years ago on this, and Gosel has since done a more general paper. But so I want to look at the way curvature perturbations are generated in inflation in a field theoretic sense. And here's the equation of motion for a density perturbation in inflation. So why is it that the gravity wave modes are such an incredible signal for inflation that tell us something we didn't know from the density perturbations is what I want to talk about. And so the curvature perturbation, zeta, the variable that determines the curvature is this thing right here. And to form a canonically quantized mode, you actually have to construct a mode function that looks like this, where this potential, essentially, z, is given by the scale factor times the square root of 2 epsilon, where epsilon, this parameter, is the first slow roll parameter, which determines the equation of state of the universe during whatever period you're interested in talking about. So epsilon is 3/2 rho plus p. And if you're in an inflationary epoch, this epsilon has to be less than unity. Okay, so this thing is an equation of state parameter. And the equation for this thing is just a Klein-Gordon equation with a variable mass, where the mass term goes like z double prime over z. Okay, and it's this thing that is doing all the work for generating superhorizon perturbations in a way that I'll show you. So if I want to have approximately scale invariant perturbations, like we observe in the real universe, it turns out that this z double prime over z, this mass term, has to go like 2 over the conformal time squared. It goes as 2 over tau squared. That is the result that gives you exact scale invariance. Approximate scale invariance, this argument still holds. It's just that this 2 ends up being modified by some small parameters, some slow roll parameters on the side. Okay? So I'm just going to talk about the scale invariant case. So in order to have scale invariance, I have to have this. Z double prime over z goes like 2 over tau squared. And I'm going to call this a freeze-out horizon. That is that the freeze-out, this length here is a characteristic length scale. The conformal time is negative during inflation and tending towards 0. And what you see here is this freeze-out horizon just decreases with conformal time. You have a shrinking, co-moving horizon size where the horizon is actually given by the inverse of that thing right there. That's what determines when modes freeze out and become classical in an inflationary universe. Well, the thing is, that's not the Hubble length, okay? The characteristic length that governs mode freezing during inflation is not the Hubble length, which is what you usually read in the textbooks. It's this other weird thing that depends on the scale factor and the equation of state. So in order to have generation of perturbations on superhorizon scales, you have to have a shrinking freeze-out horizon. The Hubble length doesn't necessarily have to be getting smaller in order to generate scale invariant density perturbations. It's just this thing, okay? And it just so happens that in slow roll inflation, these two things track each other. They have the same behavior. But in a more general case, that's not true, right? The general case, this freeze-out horizon is not the same thing as the Hubble length. And all you need to do in order to generate density perturbations that are consistent with, say, Planck, is have this thing shrinking regardless of what the Hubble length is doing. For example, you can construct models with rapidly time-varying equations of state that are expanding but still generate superhorizon perturbations. And so this is the fundamental reason why people weren't saying immediately, as soon as they saw scale invariant density perturbations in the cosmic microwave background, that, aha, this is a smoking gun for inflation, because in fact it's not, because of the fact that you have this confounding parameter, that the curvature perturbations are this mix of the space-time dynamics and the equation of state of the cosmological matter when the perturbations are being laid down, and therefore inflation is not a unique generator of scale invariant density perturbations. Okay, so what conditions, what's the most general thing we can say by saying we have scale invariant density perturbations? And this is a paper that Gazel and I and my graduate student Nazat Mordinejad wrote, is basically you can show that in an expanding universe, as long as you just limit yourself to 4D gravity, Latham, then we can have scale invariant density perturbations. As long as you have an expanding universe in 4D gravity, there's only three possibilities. You either have to have accelerated expansion, i.e. inflation. You could have a superluminal sound speed. In particular, you have to have an average speed of sound that's in excess of 10 times the speed of light.
Same as faster than speed of light.
Right. Yes, right. So, and this, there's a lot of debate as to whether these theories are, are self-consistent or not. But in principle, it's possible. Or otherwise, you're forced to, by continuity, to have incredibly super Planckian energy densities. You have to have an initial energy density at the onset of perturbation generation of 10 to the 868 times the Planck mass, which is a number I really love. Okay? So these are basically the only three possibilities, but they're all possibilities. And so you can't really say, aha, I know that this had to be caused by accelerated expansion, because there's still wiggle room for you to get out of it. Not much wiggle room, I would argue, but there's still a little bit of wiggle room. This is why tensors are so important. So here's the equivalent quantum equation for tensor modes. And now this time-dependent, it looks exactly like the scalar equation, right? Except the time-dependent mass in this Klein-Gordon equation now depends only on the scale factor, not on the equation of state. It just goes like A double prime over A. So I know that in order to have scale invariant tensor perturbations, say, A double prime over A has to go like 2 over tau squared. And that means I can just solve directly for the scale factor. I can say what's happening to the Hubble length, because I don't have that confounding element of having the equation of state wandered in, mixed in there. And that tells me immediately that my quantum mode, the most general solution to this thing, is either a 1 over tau squared, or this should be an A, not a V. I'm sorry. It's a typo. So the scale factor either goes like tau squared or 1 over tau squared. So this is a collapsing universe, this is a matter bounce, and this is inflation. Those are the only two possibilities for generating superhorizon tensor modes. And matter bounces have their own issues. I mean, in principle, that you would be generating tensor perturbations during a matter bounce as well. But those are known to be unstable to scalar perturbations and have a variety of other pathologies. So this is pretty strong evidence, and of course, this would be a collapsing universe, not an expanding one. So one question you want to ask, and it's a really important one that we need an answer to, is the tensor spectrum really close to scale invariant? I think one can make a pretty general argument based on any kind of superhorizon correlation in the tensor modes that you have to have accelerating expansion. This particular argument is relying on scale invariance, and we don't really know that they're scale invariant, we just know that they're big enough. So measuring the shape of the tensor power spectrum is going to be an incredibly important thing to do. If we can really show that these things are arguably close to scale invariant, then I think that, you know, basically you inflation has won. Yeah?
What about the gravitational wave modes? You have to go through the horizon to see.
No, Quad is observing them on superhorizon scales already. I'm sorry, Bicep is, right? That's outside the horizon. They're seeing correlations in the B mode that are already superhorizon scale. That's done, right? So you have to have superhorizon tensor perturbations.
The arguments of the matter power, the bouncing models, gravitational modes don't come through the horizon.
I am of the opinion that bouncing models don't work for a variety of reasons, and that would be one of them. So there's lots of problems with this, and so I think that In this case, however, if we just want to say in an expanding universe, in fact, these two other possibilities at the superluminal sound speed or super Planckian energy densities, those are essentially ruled out now that we've seen the tensor modes. Okay.
Why?
I'm not going to go into the details of the argument. It would be too lengthy. So you could do it with initial conditions if you wanted. So whatever, I mean, something quantum gravitational might explain all of this at the end of the day. But basically, if you accept that this dynamical explanation is why you have tensor modes in the first place, then there's only one way to do it, accelerated expansion. That's it. That's the only way. What? Well, like I said, if you accept that this is the dynamical equation for the tensor modes, which just comes from GR, right? As soon as you assume Einstein gravity, this is what you've got. And the only way to do, and the only way to generate tensor modes consistent with BICEP is by accelerated expansion.
So are you saying other proposals that have string, et cetera, mechanisms for generating these things are ruled out?
Superhorizon correlations, you have to have accelerated expansion. You might be generating the perturbations on subhorizon scales using a different mechanism than this, but you still have to have inflation to stretch them out to superhorizon scales.
Okay,
right?
I don't have the bug in the
mind. Yeah, yeah. So that's the point, is that this is, you know, this conclusion is a little bit more general than just this assumption. And Gosel recently wrote a very nice paper looking at very general Lagrangians and alternate mechanisms that show that this conclusion is actually more general than the one I'm presenting here. And I can refer, you can talk to her about that, because it's a really cool paper.
The point is that VSL models, you cannot modify GR. You can modify that.
Well, yeah, okay, if you want to modify GR, you might be able to get around it.
Do I have to write papers every time?
Okay, I'm taking standard 4D Einstein gravity here, so.
You can rule something out.
In an expanding universe with Einstein gravity.
Good.
Okay, so superhorizon correlations. This is really the big thing. This is the huge punchline that you want to get out of BICEP, is they've seen superhorizon correlations in gravity wave modes, and that tells you accelerated expansion, unless you want to have like real strong modifications to GR or something like that. Okay, I'm not going to talk much about Gaussianity, except that Planck didn't see any to an incredibly high degree, and this is where this bottle of wine came from. So Cliff and I had a bet. The stake is one bottle of New York wine versus one bottle of Ontario wine for whether or not there would be two sigma evidence for non-Gaussianity in the first Planck release.
And you'll notice it does not say primordial non-Gaussianity.
That's true.
What's the date?
This was about a year ago. About a year and a half ago now. And so the second bet, which is still ongoing, is for two sigma evidence for non-Gaussianity in the final Planck release, and that's a bottle of scotch that we have on that one, and I think I'm pretty well in the running, which is good because it looks like I'm very likely to lose a bottle of scotch to Latham, because I bet him that the tensor scalar ratio would be below 10 to the minus 2. So I'm coming out even, and yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope whoever ends up with it, you're willing to share. Okay. So we're Gaussian statistics. And basically, the takeaway from all of this is that simple, canonical, single-field models of inflation are fully consistent with the data. Okay? That we don't need to go any further than this as far as the existing data tells us. All right? And that's pretty cool. You know, maybe that's disappointing to a lot of people who have come up with extremely elaborate theories, but basically, if you had a strongly non-canonical theory, if you had something like a DBI inflation, you would run afoul of the Gaussian statistics, et cetera, et cetera. So as far as we can tell, that just a simple single scalar field model is good enough. Multiple scalar fields, once again, would tend to generate non-Gaussianity that you'd be able to see. So simple single-field canonical models look like they're still consistent with the data. And so I want to take a look now in the second half of this talk. I want to talk about the implications of Planck for single-field inflation. What do we learn about these simple one-field inflation models, and what can we potentially learn going forward about them? Okay. And I want to cover three things that I think are lessons from Planck. And of course, from BICEP as well, but a lot of this is coming from consequences of the Planck data. Is we have now very good evidence for a departure from scale invariance. which is telling you that there's dynamics happening, right? So if we were perfectly scale invariant, that would imply some sort of De Sitter symmetry, and we wouldn't have any access to any of the dynamics during inflation. Something that I think has not been sufficiently emphasized in the literature is that there is also very compelling evidence for a time-dependent equation of state during inflation, that you don't have something with a constant equation of state, that you actually are seeing evidence for a shift in the equation of state of the inflaton with time, which I think is very interesting. And then I want to talk about this general issue of mass suppression, this idea that if any of these models are going to work, you have to have a hierarchy in this potential. You have to have a flat potential. So if it's something, this is the standard cartoon picture of an inflationary potential, you have a height that's going to be some energy scale to the fourth, which we now know is about 2 times 10 to the 16 GeV, which tells you that width, in order to have this nice flat potential, is this width has to be on the order of the Planck mass or several Planck masses now, right? So now we know, BICEP has now told us what those numbers are. This number is 2.2 times 10 to the 16 GeV to the fourth. This number is several Planck masses.
Well, just a question. Isn't the energy scale dependent on the number of people?
Slight logarithmically, yeah.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. So it's not terribly sensitive to it. Well, I mean, the number of E-folds depends on the reheat temperature primarily, right? So yeah, no, this height actually, it doesn't depend on the reheat temperature at all. It's just the value of the Hubble constant during inflation. The number of E-folds depends on whether or not you reheat all the way up to this or whether you reheat down to a lower temperature. But this scale is set just by the Hubble parameter during inflation, by the amplitude of the tensor mode. So I take that back.
Mu, I guess
maybe. Mu, on the other hand, yeah. I mean, mu is not nearly as well constrained as lambda now,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. And, well, this is what I'm going to be talking about is, you know, what do we learn? But lambda is just fixed. It's just that because the tensor amplitude is h over 2 pi.
Yeah.
And you measure the tensor amplitude, you measure h.
See, once you choose the model,
then the energy yes, you're right. And that stuff, then later stuff becomes model dependent. But that value of lambda is not model dependent. Yeah. So we know how high that is. So the question is, how do we generate this hierarchy? And in particular, now particle theorists are going to have to work very hard to explain, create models with field excursions, several Planck scales, right? It doesn't, string theory doesn't do it. In fact, just about, I think, Gosel, were you saying that every string model in Clift's review is now ruled out? No, axion monodromy is dead. I'll show you that. Yep.
Test for string theory.
Well,
does it?
Well, if you want to use inflation as a test of string theory, and string theory is doing very badly, right? Because string models, basically, the problem is that you don't have enough room in that compactified manifold for this field to roll far enough is the basic problem. And even when you pull tricks like monodromy, it turns out that at least Eva's published axion monodromy model doesn't work. Okay. Oh, if she can come up with a monodromy potential that's different, right? So that's a model-dependent statement. But the phi to the two-third potential that's in the monodromy paper is dead.
The other wild card is that we got an email this morning from Anna and I, from a guy saying that he had a model which gave a bigger value of R, and we did not include it in our review.
Yeah, now it begins, yeah. there's going to be thousands of papers saying, I knew this all along, and I've been saying it the whole time, right? So let's look at departure from scale invariance, which is the easiest thing. So this is Planck results. BICEP is coming up, don't worry. So this is the tensor scalar ratio measured at 0.05 h megaparsecs inverse, which is a little different than the BICEP figures, which have 0.02, just to be complete. The shaded regions are Planck plus ACT plus SPT with WMAP polarization. The dotted lines are Planck and large-scale structure data, baryon acoustic oscillation data, so that they're in reasonable agreement.
There was an update from Planck on that right thing. Is this the latest result?
These plots are with the initial Planck data release.
I have a paper from yesterday.
Okay, no, I didn't run the chains against this yesterday. I tried. I'm not sure. I can't comment on that. Okay. So, but what you see here is that you see several sigma. I mean, scale invariance is over here at spectral index of 1. So this is the spectral index of the scalar perturbations and the tensor scalar ratio. You have very convincing, many sigma evidence that you are not in a scale invariant universe at this point. Okay. And that tells you that the energy density during inflation is varying with time, right? In the scale invariant case, you have an exactly constant Hubble constant. The horizon size stays constant in co-moving units. This tells you that the horizon size is actually growing during inflation, okay? And so this tells you that this energy scale lambda actually has dynamics, observable dynamics during the period in which the inflationary perturbations are being laid down, the observable perturbations. So that's the first conclusion, is you have evidence of dynamics from a deviation from scale invariance. This tells you that you're dealing with not just some sort of cosmological constant, but a dynamical variable that has to have an order parameter, some sort of scalar field, all right? So one question you might ask is, are we looking at sort of small field inflationary potentials, things that look like a Higgs boson, or these large field models, these chaotic inflation models where you just have a simple m squared phi squared and just send the field up a few Planck scales and let it roll down from on high? This is one basic question that you would like to answer with cosmic microwave background physics. And unfortunately, the data are still ambiguous about this point. Either one of these possibilities is still marginally consistent with the data. And with respect to this width, this scale mu here, right, we do have a pretty good measurement of that because the distance the field travels during inflation, this is over the range necessary to generate cosmic microwave background fluctuations, in units of the reduced Planck mass is just the square root of 2 times the tensor scalar ratio. Okay? So if I have a tensor scalar, if I have delta phi that is considerably less than m Planck, I'm going to have suppression of tensor scalar ratio below 0.10 to the minus 2, and I'm going to have a very, very low energy scale, right? So that's ruled out now by the BICEP data. We know that we have to have delta phi of order the reduced Planck mass in order for to create tensor perturbations of the amplitude that we've seen. So that tells us that the width of that thing, the width of that potential, the VEV of the field, if you like, has to be at least the reduced Planck mass and can, in fact, be several times as large depending on the kind of model you're talking about. But this is a model-independent result. All it depends is that you're talking about single-field inflation. Okay? Whoops. Okay, I guess I'll skip that slide. Half of it is missing. Okay. Well, I can talk a little bit about this. This column was what experiment will be capable of measuring R to this level. And this one was kind of what you would learn. So R of order 0.1 is characteristic of these potentials like m squared phi squared. R a little bit smaller is you're looking at things that look like one minus m squared phi squared. And if you want to have very strongly suppressed tensor scalar ratios, you have to have a very suppressed mass term. Okay. So the degree to which we have, the smaller the tensor scalar ratio is, the more suppression you have to have in the mass scale of the inflaton, effectively. And so here is the sort of the current status with respect to the BICEP data. So here's the Planck errors, and now the shaded regions are the dark shaded region is the 1 sigma allowed region from BICEP, and the light shaded region is 2 sigma allowed from BICEP. And in fact, there's tension there, but the tension isn't overwhelming yet. There's a lot of kumbaya going on at the 2 sigma level anyway. Okay. And here for a reference is the prediction of a simple Higgs-like potential, right? A 1 minus phi squared squared, something that would be like a Mexican hat kind of a potential, a spontaneous symmetry breaking potential, actually is a pretty good fit to the data as long as you have the width of this thing. This is not the reduced Planck mass now, so there's a factor of 8 pi running around in here. But this is so that you have to have a width of this thing. You have to have a Higgs-like potential, but the width of that potential has to be several times the Planck scale in order to be consistent with the BICEP data at this point. But one could just stop here and say here's the punchline, is that you don't need anything more than the same kind of potential that you have for the Higgs boson, except at much, much higher scale, and that would be a perfectly good explanation for the data that we have now. It could just be a grand unified Higgs with a VEV of a few Planck scales and a height of a couple times 10 to the 16 GeV. You're done. It fits.
You're saying this sort of
That is in tension with the Planck data, but it still fits. Yeah, so it could be just a purely chaotic inflation still works. So we are not yet at the point where we can tell the difference between those two. Where in fact the favored region is at the point where this one starts to interpolate into that one, right? If you make this thing wide enough and high enough, then it starts to look like this from the point of view of inflation. Inflation starts happening down here, right? And so it looks essentially, you can see that on this plot, that if I make the field big enough, it starts acting exactly like an m squared phi squared model, because what's happening is that this potential is so wide and so high that you're inflating down here on the very close to the VEV of the field rather than up here on the flat region. Does that answer your question? The tilt of the gravity waves. Well, we haven't measured that yet, right? I can write it down, which is that where the scalar goes as k to the 1 minus 4 epsilon plus 2 eta. So the nice thing is now that we have both of these, we can measure epsilon and eta separately, right? So this epsilon is just the epsilon I mentioned before. That's the equation of state parameter, right? So you expect that the spectrum will always be red. This is the epsilon is positive definite, so you always have more power on large scales and less power on small scales. So this is a consistency test of inflation, right? So if we can measure the shape of the tensor power spectrum and measure that thing, we can test whether or not it's consistent with what we know about the spectral index. Right, yeah, so R is equal to 16 epsilon is equal to 0.2, so epsilon's around 0.01 or so, right? So you should be very close to scale invariant in the tensor spectrum to be consistent. Yeah, you could, absolutely. So if this turns out to be different than that, then at least single field models are killed. And there's an inequality that is actually generalizes to multi-field models as well. So that's an important consistency test. Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. Oh, hell if I know. I mean, I.
You know. Is online, so I mean, you can in principle do the picture yourself.
Yeah. The thing is that.
You need to independent measurements.
Yeah, I mean, that's. But the thing is that this is. Yeah.
I mean, there are multiple data points.
Yeah. But they're pretty close. What you want to do is you want to measure the reionization bump as well, which you have to do from space. Right? So you need a large-scale measurement. If you really want to nail this down, you want to get the low multipoles. And so, but the thing is that R of 0.2 is potentially big enough for Planck to see it in its polarization. Right? So I would be very excited if Planck comes out and says, we see the reionization bump in the B mode, because then you can really start to measure this stuff. And it's actually conceivable that in their polarization release, Planck will have the sensitivity to do that. Probably someone on the Planck team is here and knows the answer and can't tell me.
In the Planck 2013 papers, they claim to have that power law inflation is disfavored.
Yes, I'm going to get to that, power law inflation.
Not as strong yet.
Yes, that's actually my next set of slides. Okay. Sure.
The tilt that you have over there—that's not really the bisect result, right?
No. That's from inflation theory. That's a theoretical result.
But the bisect result is running on the power law.
We'll talk about that too. Yeah. Right. I don't think you necessarily say you have to. You need running yet. There's tension here, but like I said, to 2 sigma, you don't need the running. This is okay. So this is the Planck. This is an important point. This is the Planck constraint with no running of the spectral index. Okay, which is not what they showed in the figure in the bicep paper, and that's an important point. Okay, let's talk about running. Actually, nice timing. In Planck, there's no evidence for running of the spectral index, and in particular, positive running is ruled out a lot. So what these error bars are Planck. Plus large-scale structure. The blue contours are assuming running, but no tensors. So they have a prior of 0 tensors here. So you probably want to look at the red contour now. And so this is Planck with running and tensors, and this is what you get. And what you see here is that if you have a significant tensor signal, in order to keep that consistent with the Planck data, what you have to have is you have to have a pretty significant negative running. Okay? I don't think that would, the signal is small enough, I don't think that would affect this plot a whole lot if you had some running for NT. But, yeah, I know people are going to start adding terms to that now, aren't they? So in any case, this is where the results are from Planck, is that, you know, you are consistent with zero running, but if you want to include tensors, a big tensor signal, then you probably are going to get pushed toward negative running. And that's the point that Martino was bringing up. Well, yeah, in fact, that all of these simple slow roll models are ruled out then. Just about every model ever proposed is wrong if you have running to the level that you require. So, and so here is the figure from the BICEP paper, which is now this. Notice here the upper limit on the tensor scalar ratio is around 0.17 or so. That's if you assume no running. If you allow running of the spectral index, the upper limit goes up to around 0.35 or so from Planck alone. And so now you see that there's overlap at the one sigma level. So this is the result from BICEP. So you have a tensor scalar ratio between 0.1 and 0.3 to 2 sigma. And, you know, so best fit region would be right around 0.2 there. So, and but this would require that you include a running spectral index in order to have this concordance between these two observations. That's not the only modification that could do it. In fact, another one that is, I think, perhaps better motivated would be a neutrino mass would do it. So a few tenths of an EV neutrino mass would get you would make these two guys live together a little bit better, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. So there's an indication of some tension here that needs to be resolved, and maybe the way the tension will be resolved is that the CMB polarization measurements will come down a shade. If you had a tensor scalar ratio of around 0.1 or so, I mean, if you move that error bar down here, then everybody would be happy with no running. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. Where these are going to finally settle in, I think, is too early to tell. So this tension is worth paying attention to, but it's not worth panicking about yet, probably. You know, I wouldn't call it a clear signal of an inconsistency, to my eye, anyway. But it is a little worrisome, and there you can, for example, resolve it with running. You could resolve it with a neutrino mass. Maybe this is telling us about some really interesting physics, and we will learn that what that interesting physics is very quickly as soon as these measurements become more accurate. Once again, that signal from BICEP is so big that now all these super sensitive measurements that were being built to measure to 10 to the minus 2 are going to just going to be able to nail this. It's, you know, it's not even going to be hard. So, well, it'll be hard. That's easy for a theorist to say, isn't it? Yeah. So the future is bright here, right? I mean, there's lots of, man, this is going to be a gold mine, right? So now to the power law inflation.
One other issue. In the paper from yesterday, they only exclude 4 prime chunk by 2 sigma. I don't find that.
Yeah, if foreground removal is tough here. So you want to see another measurement do the same thing. You want to look at a different patch of sky with a different technology and...
Before you start, I'm talking to champagne.
I'm just doing the wine for the non-Gaussianity right now. Latham doesn't get a scotch until we have at least one more measurement. It's exciting. I'm thrilled. Okay, so let's talk about power law inflation, right? So if we assume that the equation of state of the universe is constant during inflation, if we take this epsilon parameter to be exactly constant, we can just solve for the inflationary potential, right? We have the scale factor goes as a power law that goes as t to the 1 over epsilon. You can back out what the shape of the inflationary potential has to be. It's this. It's an exponential potential is the one that gives you an exactly constant equation of state. And therefore, you have a relationship between the spectral index and the tensor scalar ratio that n minus 1 is minus r over 8 minus 2r. There's a fixed relationship. And if you plot that relative to Planck, that exponential potential lives way up here. And it is outside the Planck error regions by several sigma. You cannot fix this with running because this model intrinsically doesn't have any running because the equation of state is a constant. It can't run. And so this thing, I would still argue, even in light of BICEP, is still strongly ruled out by the data. So this is our second indication of dynamics. The first indication is that we can tell that the energy density during inflation has time variation. We can tell that by the non-scale invariance of the power spectrum. Now, we also have indication of the dynamics. The equation of state of the inflaton field, essentially the curvature of the inflaton potential, is also changing measurably during inflation. And we can measure that by the deviation from this power law inflation model. And this is a point that I think very few people have made, and I think deserves to be made, right? So that we're actually seeing indications of dynamics at multiple levels coming out of the data now that are telling us something about what the physics that's happening during inflation. It's not just a blank quasi-De Sitter universe anymore. We can measure the dynamics. And this is really one of the big lessons from the Planck data as far as I'm concerned. So finally, I'm going to finish up very quickly at this point by talking about this issue of mass suppression, okay? Which is, I mean, when I originally came to give a talk here, I was going to give a very clever and convincing argument as to why the tensor scalar ratio should be smaller than 10 to the minus 2. never have I been happier to be wrong. This issue is still present even if you don't have a strongly suppressed tensor scalar ratio. You still have to worry about it, just not quite as much. And here's the basic problem. Is that if you look at radiative corrections in any of these kind of simple scalar field models, and especially ones that are based on supergravity, but the problem is wider than that, basically there's a generic problem that if I compute the radiative corrections to this thing, if I look at how loops contribute to the inflaton mass, what I find generically is that the mass of the inflaton is driven up to the Hubble scale. That's just, you know, any scalar loop that goes in there, you're going to just like push that right up. And gives you a problem because that tells you that the second slow roll parameter, eta, that goes into the spectral index is of order unity. Now we know epsilon is 10 to the minus 2. If this thing is of order unity, then we're screwed. It doesn't fit the data. Okay? Not only that, but inflation ends too quickly and you have all sorts of other problems, right? So this is something that you want to answer in your particle physics theory. Whoever comes up with the final model that's going to explain all of this, these beautiful observations, has to explain how you suppress these radiative corrections, why you don't have them.
This is the Higgs mass hierarchy.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so with the standard model Higgs boson, the solution to that problem is you ignore it, right? And so the solution to this may be that we just ignore it too, but it's there. And actually, there is a pretty good way to solve the problem, which is with shift symmetries. And lots of models, string-based and non-string-based, intrinsically include a shift symmetry of one sort or another. And it's for exactly that reason that you can't maintain this hierarchy radiatively or even often generated at tree level unless you have some sort of symmetry that's protecting the mass of the inflaton field to begin with. So any symmetry such that the field, the Lagrangian is symmetric if I just shift the field value, right, is that actually then tells me that at tree level I have zero mass and I have to explicitly break that symmetry in order to generate a mass term for the inflaton at all. Okay? And so in shift symmetric theories, typically what you see is that there's no potential at all, there's no dynamics at all until you actually go, the radiative corrections are the thing that generate the inflaton potential in the first place. And then this hierarchy between the height and the width of the potential is radiatively stable because it's being generated by radiative corrections to begin with.
Is a pi squared model having the same problem or not? Suppose I have m squared pi squared,
yeah,
and
sure.
This is the only term that
right, but
breaks
if you,
shift symmetry.
Yeah.
Then it doesn't generate any vertices. Or with
gravity? No, I hesitate to say in general. You have to couple it to something,
sure,
right?
Of course, yeah.
And then I think you have the problem.
Can I then couple it to derivative, or is this
wrong? I'm not going to go so far as to say a shift symmetry is the only way to get around the problem, but it's certainly one of the few ways that have been successfully proposed in models, right? And this is very widespread, and it's an elegant way to do it. And so I want to specialize and talk about these shift symmetric models now. And compare them to the data and see how they're doing with respect to what we know from the CMB. M squared, phi squared is still in play, just strictly phenomenologically. Yeah. I think as long as it's coupled to the standard model, that you got to worry about it. Yeah. So it's the devil's in the details, but maybe you're right.
It's a limit of what you have. an m squared phi squared limit of?
It is. I mean, so you can certainly have an m squared phi squared that ends up being a limiting case of a shift symmetric model anyway. So you can definitely get rid of it that way, right? So
if you're talking for a gut scale, which you're doing at the beginning, as R is 0.2.
Mm-hmm. These have to be, yeah, the height of this has to be gut scale.
X minus hierarchy problem becomes a nightmare. Because it goes like m squared log m squared over u squared.
Yep.
And n is 10 to the 16, so you
I know.
It's nuts.
Yeah, it is.
Don't ignore it.
I won't. But this is the problem. This high tensor scalar ratio is going to just like be hell for theorists, because as soon as you start to consider the wider particle physics implications, you get into tons of trouble when you have things that are five Planck masses wide and with a height at the gut scale. It's hard. Yeah. Okay. So there are a lot of ways to do shift symmetric potentials, and here's just like sort of a laundry list of some of my favorite ones, including some from my long ago PhD thesis. So this is something I've been worrying about for a long time. So the original version of it is a cosine potential, but you can have all sorts of other forms for the potential depending on how your symmetry breaking happens and so on. String-based as well, so this axion monodromy model that we were talking about has a 2π/2/3 potential, and it's basically a shift symmetric Lagrangian. The reason that it works is because of a shift symmetry. So axion monodromy is just another variation of natural inflation from this point of view, right? It's the same mechanism, just a different realization of it within string theory. So the thing here is that if I just take near the, you know, sort of the top of a potential, if I'm on a hilltop, I can express the potential as an effective series, right? So I can do effective field theory. I can just express this potential as a power law. If phi over mu is small, then I'm going to be dominated by whatever the leading order term of that thing is. And there's qualitatively different behavior if that thing is a quadratic or a quartic or higher, whether the mass term is present or entirely suppressed and higher order terms are dominant during inflation. For reasons of time, I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but in particular, if the leading order term is a mass term, the spectral index ends up being quadratic in this mass scale, which is why you're driven up to the Planck scale to begin with, is that this thing can only be scale invariant if this mu is really big compared to m Planck. This is the origin of the Lyth bound, if you like. So here is a standard natural inflation model, which belongs in this class. The leading order term is quadratic. So a cosine potential lives about here. It is still consistent, quite nicely consistent with the bicep data. So natural inflation is still, standard natural inflation is still alive. You have to have a width, pretty big in Planck units. And whether or not that makes sense from a particle physics perspective, we can argue about. But the basic cosine potential from the point of view of the cosmic microwave background is still good. Axion monodromy, on the other hand, lives way down here. It is well outside the allowed region of bicep. It's way too small. So that I don't think that there's any way you're going to reconcile these two things easily. Yeah.
Does inflation fall under the rubric of natural
inflation?
Yeah. Can they just approach m squared phi squared
asymptotically? Yeah. Well, that basically you just have a whole lot of, you create the hierarchy by a large number of fields rather than by a shift symmetry. So I would argue that's a different mechanism. But it works, you're right.
That also fall on that.
Okay. Oh, boy, I don't know. I haven't plotted it. That's this kind of model, right? So in fact, if the mass term is suppressed and I don't have a curvature in the potential, I just have something that's a very flat plateau, what I find is the beautiful result that the spectral index doesn't depend on the height and width of the potential at all. It just depends on the order of the highest order operator in my effective expansion for the potential. And for any order, any p greater than or equal to 4, anything quartic or bigger, this predicts that the spectral index will be in this narrow range between 0.935 and 0.967, which is pretty remarkable given that it's right on bang on Planck. On the other hand, if you want to say that I want this mass scale to be below the Planck mass, if I want to avoid all these problems that you have for having these very high energy scales, these things live way down here in tensor scalar ratio space, so that these things have tensor scalar ratios of around 10 to the minus 3 or so. So these plateau models, at least ones that are where the VEV is sub-Planckian, are very strongly ruled out. They're dead. As doornails. Right, so these kind of low inflation, low scale inflation models with the plateau potential are seriously, seriously inconsistent with the data. There's just no way to make them work. Here is a Coleman-Weinberg potential, which is under real threat. You have to push the width of this thing up to more than 10 Planck scales in order for it to work. So Coleman-Weinberg barely gets into the 2 sigma allowed region from bicep, but most of the parameter space is dead for Coleman Weinberg. So there's a lot of blood on the tracks here, right? You know, so that here's sort of a summary of the models I've showed you, that lots and lots of stuff has been killed off by this measurement.
Okay.
I asymptotically it will. But you have to have, I mean, in the limit that this scale goes to infinity. Or I'd have to think about that, actually. No, I don't think it ever asymptotes to m squared phi squared completely. Does it? We'll talk about it. Anyway, this is, I only went up to 10 m Planck's, and it goes up to there. So you have to push the scale of that really, really, really high, and then you're okay. But and so this is kind of a logarithmic plot showing these gray bands are the allowed region from bicep, the allowed region from Planck, and all of this stuff down here, all of these, and this area is full of stringy models, for example. They're just all gone. Okay, so, and I'll finish off, and I'm sorry for the length of the talk. I hope you felt it was worth it. Here's five questions we can maybe answer. What's the shape of the tensor power spectrum? This is really important for reasons that we've discussed, and we can actually maybe hope that we'll get some insight in that from Planck soon. If they can see that reionization bump, then we'll have two scales, we'll have a decent lever arm, and we can start to constrain the spectral index of inflation, which is just remarkable. I never would have thought it was going to ever be possible to say anything about n sub t, and now I'm optimistic that we will. Do we need running of the spectral index to resolve the tension? It's not obvious that we do, but we might. Neutrino mass might be another way to do it. It might be the tension will disappear once we get once everything settles down. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Why does the neutrino mass help? I mean, we kind of reduce the power
of the
all
scale.
Yeah.
Right, we come here.
There's a degeneracy there between the neutrino mass and running, and I'm trying to remember the exact physics of why that's true. No, there's a real degeneracy there. They have similar effects. So what's the form of the leading order operator in the inflationary potential? I would say that if we can start measuring things like the tensor spectral index, we can do better than answer this question. We can actually begin a process of reconstructing the first couple of derivatives of the inflationary potential under the assumption that a single field slow roll. Once you have information about the tensor spectrum, you can actually start to reconstruct this effective expansion for the inflaton potential directly from the data. It's remarkable. And this is also now within reach because of BICEP. With such a high scale for inflation, you might think that you might see evidence for quantum gravity effects. For example, a Planck scale cutoff in the quantum dynamics. You need very high scale inflation in order to have any hope at all of seeing this stuff. And now we know we have very high scale inflation. So this stuff is really worth looking at now, because this is exactly the parameter region where you might think that these effects might be observable. And finally, what about all the CMB anomalies that I haven't mentioned, the hemispherical asymmetry, the suppression of the low multipoles, that kind of stuff? Is there some compelling theoretical reason that we might try to explain these things? It's not obvious to me that because of the fact that we can't measure these any better than we have because of cosmic variance, it's probably going to be continually a mystery whether it's just a fluke or whether this is some really important physics, you know, because unless we can see the CMB from another universe, we're never going to measure those anomalies any better than we have now. So thank you so much for your patience, and I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Different foregrounds of traction, the R, instead of being 0.2, could be 0.16 plus or minus around 0.05 or 0.06.
So, yeah.
It seems quite consistent with Planck.
Yeah, I mean, if you bring that down to 0.16 plus or minus about the same size error bar, then you've got no problem with Planck, right? Let me bring the. Let's see. see, where's the, so here, for example. So if it's down, if you shift all that down by about 0.05, then you've got, yeah, you're doing
just
okay.
A caution that I don't think they understand the systematics in there.
Yeah, it's early days.
To be added into the random ones.
It's early days. I think it's entirely conceivable that this will come down by a factor of two or so when people understand the foregrounds better and we have better measurements. I mean, I maybe it won't. Maybe it'll go up. But yeah, I mean, I think it's wise to be cautious about this as being a hard and fast issue right here. It's going to take a while for everything to settle down a bit.
In the infinite n-square phi square potential, what mass do you need?
The
simplest model in the
picture. Yeah. So this thing, I actually calculated it. It's about 10^-4 m gut is the mass of the field.
Okay. So it seems that this model is
10^12 GeV or so scalar mass. Yeah, about 10^12, if I remember rightly, it's about 10^12 GeV for a potential like this, is the actual mass of the field itself.
Now, I'm just thinking about the purely Gaussian.
It's
10^13
GeV.
So, yeah. I think you said that you had to have a Planckian width.
Right. The value of the field has to be Planckian, but the mass of the field ends up being around, sub-Planckian.
Okay, for the n-square phi-square field?
Uh-huh. I don't remember the figure for that. I know it for the Higgs, and it's about 10^12 GeV.
It's 10^13 is the mass,
yeah,
potential, but you need to displace the field by
many Planck scales.
By a few Planck scales.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you need to put it very
right. Now the energy density during inflation is well below m Planck to the fourth, so you don't have to worry about quantum gravity effects directly because of the super Planckian energy densities. It's just the only thing that has to be super Planckian is the VeV of the field, which is not necessarily a problem in field theory, but there's lots of argument about whether or not, you know, in specific contexts, whether that becomes problematic.
Comment has a question. 10 years ago, I put out a paper predicting the spectral index for my VSL.
Uh-huh.
0.96. I put out a paper recently, reminded me of that. So I have to sit down and I feel like Rocky, you know, the Rocky folks. The question is, Paul Steinhardt and Milton Julius have been putting out papers complaining about inflation. You read them?
Yes, yeah. I have read them. So John's asking about the papers by Steinhardt et al. saying that Planck was really bad for inflation. Are these the papers you're talking about?
What happens to those papers now?
I think that they were wrong when they came out. I don't think we needed to wait for BICEP in order to know that those papers were wrong. Alan Guth put out a very articulate rebuttal to those recently.
Well, yeah.
So I don't buy the arguments. I didn't buy them
to begin
with.
I put out a paper criticizing Guth's paper.
Okay, well,
for that.
Yeah, I have no dog in that fight, except that I think that Steinhardt's arguments really don't hold up.
The only fairness Paul Steinhardt is saying inflation can fit the data is a good bicep. However, there are consequences which are not great, fundamentally speaking. Let's be fair.
So let's leave this at that. Matt had a question.
I was wondering if you could comment briefly on the prospects for reconstruction, given an R of 0.2. I mean, is this something that do we need to know the running, or do we need to know the spectral index for the tensors, or what's sort of the biggest information you want?
Okay, let's. Let's take the no running case to begin with, right? Because that's less ambiguous. In that case, you need to know the tensor spectral index in order to reconstruct that first term directly. Okay, so that's what's necessary to do a direct functional reconstruction is you need to know the tensor spectral index. You can do poor man's reconstruction. You can do these Monte Carlo techniques and stuff where you just like generate models that are consistent with the data and see how similar they are to each other. But in order to do this functional to just like write down what the coefficient of the next term in that effective expansion is, the thing you need to know is the tensor spectral index. With running, Now it gets complicated, right? Because it's very difficult to include running in sort of this effective expansion and not have inflation end too quickly, have eta get big and that kind of stuff, right? So running is hard to accommodate in single field inflation in a sensible way, at least in sort of these parametric effective field theory expansions. You got to have a lot of terms, basically, in order for the running to work, and it's going to be very hard to reconstruct all of them, I would say. Does that answer your question?
No, we talked about it.
Okay.
Okay, so